Okay, so moving now to agenda paper 13, and I'm handing over to Satanik.
In March, the committee published a tentative agenda decision on the classification of a post-employment benefit plan applying IAS 19, and in particular whether the existence of a potential discount on plan contributions affect the classification of the plan. In that tentative agenda decision, the committee concluded that the existence of a potential discount would not in itself result in classifying the plan as a defined benefit plan applying IAS 19. We received 10 comment letters by the comment letter deadline. 6 respondents agreed with the committee's decisions and 4 disagreed with some aspects of the committee's technical analysis. Respondents' comments, together with our analysis, are presented in paragraphs 10 to 39 of the paper. Based on our analysis, we recommend finalizing the agenda decision as published in IFRIC update in March, subject to changes discussed in paragraphs 36 and 38 of the paper and some editorial changes. Appendix A sets out the proposed wording of the agenda decision. I would like to pause here and ask whether you agree with our recommendation.
Well, there's going to be comments on this. Okay, Guy.
Some of the additions to the tentative agenda decision about the broader considerations, I think, are good. However, I am still fussed with the downside risk notion that's fundamental to the analysis, and I still read IAS 19 to think that a more substantive view of how to look at downside risk is warranted. I think assessing it against the expected cost is going to achieve an outcome that reflects the substance of the arrangement, and I read that as being consistent with the words in the standard. I read paragraphs 28 through 30 of the standard to say I need to think about the overall substance of the arrangement. It defines actuarial risk in the context of expected cost. And I also read BC 29 to suggest that downside risk should be assessed against expected cost. The narrow view of downside risk that's fundamental to the overall analysis can ultimately lead to what I think could be incorrect plan classification determinations. And so for that reason, I would not be in favor of finalizing the agenda decision.
Can I ask Guy? Guy, just to ask you a question, and maybe I'm jumping ahead, I was going to ask you about the wording in the tentative agenda decision. Because obviously we've added some extra pieces now to the tentative agenda decision. And largely, I know that I think what you said means you disagree with some of the analysis in the paper, but is there particular words in the tentative agenda decision that make you pause in a sense? Because at least at the minute, I think it largely quotes directly from the standard. It uses, as you say, the descriptions in the standard about actuarial risk that talk about versus expectations. So I was just wondering, is there a particular piece of what's in the proposed agenda decision?
To be perfectly honest, I didn't sort of comb through to say, well, despite the analysis in the paper, I could read the agenda decision to say it's portraying a perspective that's different than the fundamental analysis in the paper. The fundamental analysis in the paper just is at odds, in my mind, with how I would have approached the issue. And so, we could maybe parse the words and say, well, I could read the agenda decision, more favorably in the way I would like to read it. But in conjunction with the fundamental analysis that underlies it, I think that's the troubling the troubling part to me.
Bob?
I'm like Guy. I continue to disagree with the staff on this one. We talked at length last time about paragraphs 20 and 30, and that if you if the discount involves is taking on significant actuarial investment experience, I just believe that that is not a defined contribution plan. But the question I have for the staff, focusing on, there's two criteria for a defined contribution plan. One is to pay fixed contribution, and the other is there's no legal or constructive obligation to pay more. And we've been focused on the cap, the pay more. But my question now is, well, how do you define fixed? And I'm not satisfied by what's in paragraph 22 of the paper. I mean, obviously, we know fixed is not fixed. The contributions will vary based on salaries, et cetera. At least mostly, you know, talk about salaries, it's a fixed percentage of salaries. At least there's something that's fixed there. I just don't know how, in my mind, I can't call it fixed when the contribution varies by actuarial and investment experience. So it just doesn't meet. So I'd like to know, you know, how should we be looking at this criteria fixed?
And I suppose I can't say more than what's in the paper. And obviously, I think you're saying, you know, that either doesn't convince you or you don't agree with it. But I suppose for us it wasn't. So I suppose we explain in paragraph 22 how we would read the words. And just to let you know, I think absolutely there's, you know, in isolation, those words can be, you know, read in different ways. It's not just that I think you can only read fixed the way we set out in paragraph 22. But how we got to that reading in paragraph 22 was the other pieces of information then that we discussed in paragraphs 23 and 24. And maybe, at least for me personally, I was in particular looking at that previous discussion the committee had where there's, you know, possible refund based on vesting conditions. Because that at least said to me when the committee said that was comfortable with that, it said fixed doesn't mean, you know, a reading of fixed that says, you know, it's always that amount and nothing can ever come back.
So let me take it to the extreme. So let's start with a defined benefit plan, one that we can all agree is a common defined benefit plan. We amend the plan to add a cap, so contributions cannot ever go above this. And obviously we're going to have to put a cap onto the benefit formula, but we put a cap on it. Does that make that plan now a defined contribution plan? It meets Part B, got the cap, but I still don't know how it's going to meet fixed. Because the only thing I've changed is put a cap on it.
So, I mean, again, I don't know if this is helpful, but I think you're asking us a question, so that's the only reason I'm trying to explain, which is I can't say more than is in the paper. I mean, we would say that the fundamental starting point is to look at exactly what has been promised, in a sense, between the company and the employees via the trust or via the plan. And is it that the employer's, you know, promise and therefore obligation is to make particular contributions? Or is it, when you look at all that, that the employer's obligation is actually that they're, you know, guaranteeing or promising a particular benefit.
Can I ask something that, because I think it might follow from, so I think you're acknowledging that fixed doesn't literally mean fixed, because we know that there's some types of variability that's definitely sort of countenanced in the standard, even setting aside this particular thing that we're looking at. So I think what Bob's then focusing on is the actuarial risk part of it, which is a sort of an additional factor. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at paragraph, so it's in paragraph 16 of the paper, which quotes paragraph 30 of IAS 19, when you read B, because the second sentence of B is also focusing sort of on direction in terms of worse than expected, that's part of your of what you're looking at as well, right? When you're reading actuarial risk,
yes,
the sort of asymmetry, if you like, is reflected in the description of actuarial risk. It doesn't just stop at actuarial risk after the first sentence. It goes on and talks about direction there. Is that part of your logic?
Yeah, I think that's right. Both in 30, when it talks about, describes defined benefit plans, and when in paragraph 28, when it describes actuarial risk investment risk from a defined contribution perspective.
Andrew, I think you're next.
I had some reservations when we discussed this last time, and my reservations have probably got a bit harder. So let me just go through the points that I have on this, and we'll see where we go. So if I start in the definition of a defined contribution plan, which says that you pay fixed contributions into a separate entity. So I start with the notion of what I'm paying in is fixed. And then I think about it in the context of, well, what happens to those contributions once they've been made? If I go to paragraph 28, that tells me that the amount of post-employment benefits received by the employee is determined by the amount of contributions paid by an entity, together with investment returns from those contributions. That tells me that once the payments are made into the plan, those payments plus the investment returns go to the employees and not to me. And so that gives me a little bit of concern with where we're going with this, because that immediately starts to say to me, this doesn't feel like a pure DC plan because there's something else going on here. I do agree with some of the comments in the comment letters that say that if the employer could receive a refund in future, then those contributions aren't fixed and they're variable instead because it depends on future investment returns. On that question of fixed contributions and the previous discussions the committee's had, I think that a question of refund due to a failure to meet vesting conditions is a different thing. And that's because failure to meet a vesting condition means that the employer has not received the service. And I would view that differently from the fact pattern that we've got in this agenda paper. Mm-hmm. When I look at the question of funding, I look at paragraph 19 in the agenda decision, so the two scenarios, no obligation to pay more in the future versus a scheme that's hugely overfunded, I don't agree that there's a distinction to make. I think economically it's the same thing. And when I look at the question of, if I've got this plan and I have different scenarios of it's completely unfunded until the funding is required, it's funded to the expected level, or it's hugely overfunded, the only difference that I can really see with that is the existence or not of a significant financing component, because the economics of the scheme are exactly the same. So I worry with this that there would be some real structuring opportunities to get the kind of plan classification that you want. What I think IAS 19 tells you to do is to look at what the sponsor's economic exposure is or not, and then classify the plan according to that. So I don't agree with where the staff have got to on the conclusion. I think this looks much more like a defined benefit plan.
Mary?
When I read this paper, I regretted that I missed the fun of the March meeting and the initial discussion of it. And so I'm coming a bit late to the conversation, but I almost feel like the request, and I'm looking at the beginning of the agenda decision on page 13, says that it's really the submission is telling us focus only on the following issues. You know, the original language was the relevant terms and conditions are as follows. And I think the thing that nags at me, and this may be related to the concerns that Guy and Bob and Andrew expressed, but it's maybe less focused on literally the focus on fixed and discount, is I have a tremendous amount of skepticism that the contribution is really fixed and independent of the investment in actuarial return. Because while I've seen many, many plans in which a contribution level is set and agreed for, let's say, 3 or 5 or 7 years, you know, this usually involves a pension regulator, the trustees of the plan, and the entity. And then there is a reconsideration of that level after X time, you know, whatever those 3 or 5 or 7 years are. And I just can't believe that those factors don't influence the setting of what is the next, quote, fixed contribution for the following period of time. And I feel that the submission almost focuses in on this discount issue to keep us away from assessing the substance of the obligation that flows back through the determination of the fixed amount. And you know, that's maybe a bit of a cynical characterization of it. And I do have some concerns that people will pick up this. I think the additions are quite helpful in terms of starting to bring in other factors to consider. But I still feel like it lets people go in and pick out the words they want, you know, and focusing narrowly on the discount issue and say, look, this supports my DC conclusion. And when I thought, if the committee agrees fundamentally with trying to close this out without doing standard setting and offering some comment, I feel that it might be helpful to add some thought about linking the consideration of the entity's exposure, what Andrew was saying, to investment in actuarial risk to that fixed amount. Now, the paper, I don't have the paragraph in front of me, does remind us of some comments in the basis for conclusion that were added that said the existence of a benefit formula is not determinative of something being a DB plan. But for me, if this notion of a fixed contribution is in respect of a plan that has a DB, you know, a DB promise, so a DB formula, kind of my level of skepticism that the amount is fixed goes skyrocketing. So what I was thinking of is if I look at page 14, point B, is just maybe adding another thought that, the manner in which the annual contributions, and my point here is that it's a good reminder, you know, and it's the general consideration, but I think I'd rather shine a searchlight in somebody's eye and say, you know, if the plan includes a benefit formula, then the determination of the entity's obligation must consider how the fixed contribution is set and whether that indirectly or directly transfers actuarial or investment risk back. So it says you've got to think about those factors in respect of the fixed amount as something that might help. It's absolutely consistent with IS 19 because 19 says it's not just the legal, it's also the constructive obligation. And it's just saying, you know, we've been told in the submission that we should only focus on the following characteristics and assume that the amount is fixed. But I think we really have to say to somebody, when you assert that is fixed, you're not looking at like a 3 to 4 year time horizon. You really are looking at the entity's obligation overall. And one of the reasons, I'll stop talking in a minute, but one of the reasons I'm kind of a hardened skeptic about this is I remember 15 years worth of debate about the, in IS 19, how you apply the asset recognition criteria, where you say I can recognize an asset, IFRIC 13, I recognize an asset if I can get a refund or I have a reduction in future contributions. And all the debates about the application of reduction in future contributions are reduction versus what, because none of us knows what our contributions are going to be in future because it's reset. And if those were all the practice issues around recognition of an asset, I don't see where this population of plans has come out that the contribution is fixed in a way that, you know, that gives no risk. If it's truly analogous to the refund of contributions in respect of an employee who did not fulfill the vesting conditions, Andrew, I think that as you were saying, that's a different, you know, if this is like that, then somebody I think has a basis. And, you know, if it's a straight DC plan with no actuarial risk in it, but I think the existence of a benefit formula raises the prospect that somebody should be made to consider about why that combined with resetting the fixed amount doesn't produce a DB obligation. So with all that said, I think a sentence that said, not just the generic that's in B, but that says you must look at how fixed is set, would help address some of the concerns that I've heard from some of the members so far.
Reactions from the staff before I move on?
Sure, I'll try to address in the fact pattern, Mary. I understand that when we have a target benefit formula, it creates, most often creates a constructive obligation from the entity to increase contributions whenever there is not enough in the fund. So what we try to do, we try to limit, and those are the terms and conditions of the plan in the submission that we try to address, that the entity has determined that it will not have any further obligations. So we try to limit this to the fact patterns where the entity doesn't have any constructive obligations. So if in 5 years' time, trustees come back to the entity to say, you know, there's not enough assets in the fund and the entity need to increase, or the entity determined that it will not increase because there is no constructive obligation. Maybe it's a very high hurdle, but once they overcome, they are in this fact pattern. And then we try to, in the agenda decision, in the penultimate paragraph, we noted that they need to disclose, because this most often this will be a very significant judgment that the management has made. And they made that they don't have a constructive obligation, and then they are in this fact pattern.
And maybe I'll just add one thing to that. I think the point that you raised, I agree with you. I think the moment there's a benefit formula, the skepticism goes up as to whether fixed is really fixed. We have tried to address that in the agenda decision. If we look at page 14, the second last paragraph, at the end of that paragraph, we have the four example. So we talk about the fact that to be a DC plan, you must not have any obligation. So for example, your contribution should not be set such that you would have to cover any shortfalls in future periods that relate to service that you received in the current and prior period. So we are trying to get at the same thing, I think, that Mary, you're talking about.
I recognize that it's more generic, and I want to, I just thought it would benefit. And the other factor that made me, my nervousness level go up is the basis on which they are described as getting a discount is the same basis that, that the asset to obligation ratio is in surplus is the same calculation that would lead to a requirement for an additional contribution.
If I
and that, yeah. that's I just am surprised.
Could I add one other thing? Sorry, go on, Katrina.
I was going to say, Mary, if I understand, and then at least I'm saying I think we can do that, is that it's almost like on page 14 you might have a stronger link. It's like we've mentioned, look at how you work out the contributions and the discount, and down below we have the for example. And maybe I think what you're saying is, could we make a slightly stronger link between those two by adding a few more words?
Saying, look at your assertion of fixed.
Yeah. Peter?
So a number of people have raised this question about downside versus upside, and I have a lot of sympathies with those arguments, but the question is, what does the standard actually tell us to do at the moment? And the lines of argument I've heard, to me they would say you could never have a situation where you've only got downside and not upside. For example, if you're looking at expected value, unless everything is completely fixed with no possibility of change, then there is either downside or upside. So those of you who are in that camp who think that we should be looking at it, by, for example, in terms of expectation, I'd be very interested to hear how you think it could ever arise that you could have upside but not downside.
I think that is the return of unvested portion.
Okay, Jim?
I think some of us were extremely worried about just the potential misleading or misuse we are about to put out there. Just have the company or management to bypass the complicated DB accounting and to just starting calling it DC by using the decisions. But after looking at this new draft, I felt much more comfortable with this decision because, just like some of the staff mentioned, looking at page 14, the paragraph somewhere in the middle, the committee noted such and assessing the manner in which annual contributions and the potential discounts are determined. While I was reading this part of the sentence or the paragraphs, I was thinking about similar to Mary just commented on. So, It's not telling, okay, the numbers may change, but it doesn't mean you could use it whatever situation. You got to access the manner. If the company or the management is trying to use this term in an abusive way, the auditor should think about the manner and knowing all the other circumstances and stop this treatment, sort of. So if you could add more, a little bit more comment on the manner and how to access the potential discount, it should work. So I felt this new draft is more reasonable, and I think if we go down the path, it could avoid some of the considerations or concerns we addressed so that we can go down the path without changing or sending it to the board for an amendment. So I think I'm pretty much okay with the direction, just adding a little bit more clearance on the wording so we guide the industry or the accountants toward the right way of thinking.
Gary?
Thank you. You know, in the last several years, we've taken several runs at hybrid plans in the organization. And in each and every case, we sort of came up, this is a much bigger project and phenomena to work with than a simple solution. And I don't know if this is viewed as a hybrid plan or not, but as we start commingling contribution formulas and benefit formulas, it functionally is a hybrid plan. And we've been unable to make any substantive progress on that, as both IC, the full board, and elsewhere. So my recommendation would be, I think we stick to the very narrow question that's on the table. Does the existence of a refund or the possibility of a refund affect plan classification? Because as this discussion's going, as you start meandering different directions, you're bumping into all the same issues we've been unable to make progress on. I think I don't recall from when reading the original submission, was I'm reading the opening paragraphs on page 13 defining it. This plan came to me, I'd say it's a defined benefit plan. I don't know if it is or not. You know, because you've got, to me, a classic defined contribution plan, assets always equal liabilities. Because the contributions of the employees, you know, monies. Here they're talking about actuarial assumptions and plan assets and plan liabilities at certain levels. That's DB. That's not defined contribution discussion. Be that as it may, I don't think that's all that relevant to a very narrow question, which could be asked on their behalf, or playing on a client behalf, or more generically, is does the existence of a refund by itself affect classification? I think I support the staff analysis where we came out that by itself it doesn't. We talked easily about, well, if you don't vest, is that a refund or is it, practically speaking, it's an adjustment to next year's contributions. Likewise, when we talk about fixed contributions, a classic DC plan could be articulated as 5% of pay will contribute to the fund each year, but you could have a profit-sharing element on top of that. And if corporate profits exceed a certain level, you'll get an extra 1% contribution each year for every certain amount you exceed group profits and so on. That's not, it's a fixed formula, but the contribution itself is not fixed about it. But the essence of it all is, what is the promise that the employee expects to benefit from? You know, an actuarial plan developed in terms of, age, years of service, final pay that, comes out with a formula, or there's the promise, I'm going to put a certain amount of money in the bank, and it is what it is. And which in that case, technically, you wouldn't even need a benefit formula, that says I get the higher of or the lower of or whatever. So honestly, my advice, keep it just to the very narrow question, because like I say, we've been unsuccessful moving the ball forward on hybrid plans in the 7 years I've been here. And it's not an easy discussion.
Bertrand?
I totally agree with Gary. We just need to focus effectively on answering the narrow question.
And in a sense, what the draft agenda decision is saying is just that in itself, a discount is not precluding the entity from a DC classification. Maybe to answer Bob and Mary's concerns about this notion of viability, like Jawad pointed out, I think we had this discussion in March. In March, and we added in the draft tentative that agenda decision at the time all this, would you say that, this second last, yeah, the second last, you said, the second last paragraph of page 14. And I think the important thing, the important part there is the fact that not be obliged to pay further contributions if the fund does not hold sufficient assets to pay all employee benefits relating to employee service in the current or prior periods. So if you think, because otherwise, let's for some state plans, you, the government, the Social Security or whatever, might increase the contribution for future service periods. As long as there is no catch-up on the prior and past, on the past periods, you wouldn't classify a state plan as a defined benefit plan. It wouldn't come to anybody's mind. We're in the same situation there. And so I think the point is, if the contribution would increase, and potentially this increase would be a compensation at a certain time for past services, then obviously, effectively, I concur with the view that it's no longer a DC plan. And all this paragraph was added just to avoid the structuring that some fear might happen. But I totally agree. Despite that, I mean, I totally agree with Gary. The question is not this one. And there, I think we limit really the risk of structuring. And the question is really, what about if there is a discount? Does the discount in itself preclude the entity from a DC classification? We are answering there no. But the discount plus other elements in the fact pattern applying judgment leads to conclude that it's not a DC plan but a DB plan.
Reinhard?
So, sorry, yeah, I agree with the staff analysis, staff conclusion, draft quarters of the agenda paper. Sorry, I didn't mention that. So, it was pretty obvious in my comments.
Comments may sound like a classical Canadian compromise, but it's very similar to what Mary said, Bertrand and Gary, as well as Jim. I think the concern is wherever you have received refunds, whether the entity as a consequence is taking on actuarial investment risk, in particular in this circumstance because of the way the refund is determined. And so I think if we focus on the narrow question as to whether a refund in and of itself causes you to be a DB plan, I think we can proceed in that direction. And I think the improvements the additions that the staff made to the tentative agenda decision are helpful. Along the lines of what Mary said, I think where we come to the, either in the concluding paragraph or earlier, where we talk about the impact of the refund and that it in and of itself does not cause it to be a DB plan, I think it's really important to have cautionary language that you need to step back and look at all of the terms and conditions and assess whether as a consequence you're taking on investment actuarial risk and effectively because it is a DB plan. And so I think it would be helpful to make that caution and then very narrowly focus this on that particular question on refund.
Okay, thank you. Tony.
So I actually think we have been addressing a very narrow question throughout, because I think the question we've been addressing is if there's a right to a discount, are the contributions fixed? Because I think continues to be quite a strong argument that says if I can get some of the money back, then it's not fixed.
I think that's largely the point that Andrew and Bob and Guy and I made last time, and I think that remains the question. I think the right to a refund if the employees don't deliver the service is a bit of a red herring in this context, because like Andrew said, I think that's an executory arrangement. It's not necessarily an exposure to actuarial risk. So I have some of the same reservations, but having said that, and sort of thinking about how we move it forward, I think the changes that the staff have suggested are extremely helpful. And I think it gets a lot of the things that I think the existence of the right to a potential refund creates doubt and says you've got to go away thinking about it. And I think a lot of what the staff has added emphasizes what you need to go away and think about. And I think if we sort of take Mary's suggestion, which I think is helpful, and I think it links the guidance on page 14, or would help link the guidance on page 14 together with what Reinhardt said about having something in the conclusion. I do think the change you made to the concluding paragraph is helpful. The existence of a right to a potential, not the a potential, I think is helpful. And I just had a couple of other thoughts. I think when we, particularly when we talk about assessing the manner in which the annual contributions and any potential discount are determined, I wondered about manner and frequency. Because if you do that every year, to me it's giving a bit of a hint that you are tweaking the contributions every year to compensate for what happened last year or to adjust for what happened last year. So I would wonder about that. I think with the tweaks that Mary and Reinhardt suggested, I can see a way to go forward with it.
Bruce?
It's interesting listening to the debate when there's sometimes we sit around this table and we analyse words and try and get literal meanings of them, and yet here we get a word that says fixed and everybody starts screaming what doesn't mean fixed. You kind of got to pick a path. I'll tell you my view on this thing, and my view's a bit of a long way, kind of, I think, Gary and Bertram are going. I mean, to me, the focus in this is simply, does this thing sound like a DC plan? And to me, it does. Okay, they've put in an extra variable in terms of what's there. And when I say to myself, does that change the company's promise of what benefits it will give to its employees? And it doesn't. And I think that as an employee of the fund, I have exactly the same risks that I had previously. And that is that I'm getting money in it. I'm exposed to those risks that happen to money, and that kind of determines what benefit I get out of it. I'm still carrying that risk. There is a bit of benefit to the company in terms of the fact that if things go really well and that they invest in fantastic shares, they may get a bit of a holiday on that. But to me, this thing looks and smells and walks like a DC plan. And I think, to me, I don't think there's enough in there that would make me feel that I can put this in defined benefit, because I think when you go through the requirements of a defined benefit, to me the most fundamental issue of a defined benefit is that I'm responsible for what benefit the employee got. And I don't think that this one term has kind of switched it straight into that. On the other side, I mean, I will just comment that I think that IAS 19, I mean, has been around a long time, and I think like many of the stands we're seeing, the world is moving on. I mean, you talk about hybrid plans. This is one of, and I think we could sit here and debate for the next 3 hours if we wanted to, the various permutations. And I think that to get something out will be helpful, and I think at the end of the day we've got to get something out that people can use in the mock. Do I think standard setting would be good here? Absolutely. I wish we could say to the board, guys, take on a massive project on IAS 19, hybrid plans, and relook at all the permutations. We know that's not going to happen. So I think that in order to make something useful for people, I think that the agenda decision, especially with the amendments, to me, supports what we asked, and I think we get the right answer out of it.
Thank you. Young Su?
Yeah, I just want to concur with Bertrand, Reinhardt, and Bruce. I think this revised version, I mean, the current version of the agenda decision, is clear in transferring the committee's intention to the public. Especially like the ideas that the staff included the definition of the DB plan and DC plan, that makes our intention much clearer. So I should say that I like the current version of the agenda decision. And also concerning about the structuring opportunity, I think that accounting standards or translations, I mean, the interpretations, can reduce the structuring opportunities, but we cannot eliminate structuring opportunities 100%. So I think the current version of the agenda decision is reasonable enough. So I support the current version.
Martin?
Yeah, I assume the topic is sufficiently narrowed. Thought what kind of structures could be the reason for that kind of plans, and it could be in a way tax optimization. It could be that the initial contribution needs to be aligned with a regulator or so, where you have different actuarial assumptions, and then you have an agreement that the company might get back some money but never have to pay above that level for the past. So I would agree to continue with the agenda decision as drafted.
Carl?
I'm supportive as well as drafted.
Gary?
It should probably be quiet as I'm counting the votes here. I think we might come out with one to be. But just to make one comment, if you've got a contribution formula, I mean, what when you put in and how you take out, that's structured. I mean, I just don't want to think this is sort of a piggy bank and it can put surplus money in when it's convenient, revert some when it's convenient. This is, you're not going to have a tax qualified plan or a regulatory qualified plan, or you're not going to have an employee satisfactory plan. So I think it's all spelled out, you know, what your rights and limits of what you're going to do. And if you're worrying about, is it still, even if that's all I had to talk about, does it make it a DB plan? Well, if you don't have a DB formula, you know, that's tied to age, years of service, the classic form of things, and all it is a contributory arrangement, I would be hard-pressed to see it's a DB plan, because the liabilities are just whatever the plan assets are. So again, I'm back to, I think we just keep it very narrow, recognizing hybrid plans, the bias is probably more that they're DB plans, but as several people have said, I think it's the totality of the fact pattern that's involved. But in this one narrow fact pattern by itself probably does not make plan classification change in a vacuum without everything else.
Yeah, but Gary, this agenda decision in this paper does not say that there is no DB plan, there is no benefit formula. This agenda decision right now could be applied in analyzing a plan that has a DB promise.
I agree with you. I mean, but again,
but you just said that, well, that this is not, there's no DB formula. It doesn't say
no,
that.
No, I didn't say, no, it said in absent any DB formula, I'd be hard pressed to see how any arrangement could be a DB plan, because you need a benefit promise formula. That's all I would say.
Okay. Sorry, I heard it the other way around.
Oh.
Trying to be constructive, the part of the agenda decision that I'm having the hardest time with is on page 15, the third to last paragraph that starts consequently. It says the existence of a right to a potential discount would not in itself result in classifying the plan as a DB. And I agree that a right in itself doesn't, but I think that's going to be misconstrued, because I think while the right to a discount doesn't itself, you still have to consider the terms of the discount and the terms within the discount. I'm not saying in this one, and I'm not saying in all cases, because I do believe that there are cases where you'd still be DC, but I believe that there are some cases where the terms of the discount could cause this to be a DB.
Yeah, but then alongside other circumstances, potentially.
Yeah, we're not warning the reader here to consider those, you know, all the facts and circumstances in that sentence.
We'll come back with some wording suggestions. Bonnie?
I guess I wanted to put my comments on the record. I have some of the same concerns as Guy and Tony and Bob and Andrew. I think just listening to the discussion and some of the cautionary language that I think has been suggested by some would help with kind of getting me across the line on this. I understand we're trying to be helpful. It is a very narrow set of circumstances. I have a lot of the same skepticism in terms of that there's only kind of two relevant sections of the plan, and looking at a plan in totality, you need to take all the pieces into consideration. I also think what Bob has suggested would be very helpful, because it's not just the right to the discount, but it is how, in this case, the discount seems to work, could lead to that conclusion. But I think the frequency, the kind of duration, and some of those other things need to be in here to make it explicitly clear that you have to look at everything in totality, and just because there's a discount doesn't automatically mean that that would lead you to a DC conclusion.
Okay. DB conclusion.
I'm going to bring in Michael. Michael and then Goro, and then what I'm going to do is get Petrina, I'm giving you a heads up. Mm-hmm. It's often a question of control at this table. To let us know what additions you've heard suggested, yep. And then we'll take a vote. So Michael's become Ton.
Yeah. I have one question. I'm a little bit struggling with the sentence on page 14, which says, for example, there should be no possibility that future contributions could be set to cover shortfalls. And I was wondering whether, if there is a shortfall and there are new negotiations about the premium, but there is no obligation, then there might be the possibility there will be paid something extra for future services, because of shortfalls in the past. And I'm not sure whether this will bring you this situation will bring you to the classification of a defined benefit plan. And so is this not too strict as it is drafted here, that there should be no possibility? In my view, there should be no obligation.
I suppose we're thinking because obligation is both legal or constructive, mm-hmm. which is why I think, and it was sort of discussed at the last meeting, Ton, you know, these are not new words, but I think that's why at least I ask committee members if they agree, but I think that's why people felt that wording was appropriate.
Possibility is not the same as obligation, in my view. The possibility can also follow from something which is not an obligation.
I suppose I'd only say I hand it over to committee members, because I think if we suggested a change there, it might weaken the agenda decision, which seems to go in the opposite direction of where committee members
are. I really want to try and wrap this up. I'm really conscious of time. But Goro?
Thank you. From the investor's point of view, I'm very much interested in the maximum possible liability of the entity. And in that regard, I agree with the staff analysis, and the sentence which Ton suggested is exactly fact. I think that this plan should be classified as the defined contribution rather than defined benefit. Yes, there is a refund, but as far as the potential liability is limited to the certain amount, I think that the entity is not guaranteeing that any level of future benefit. So I'm very happy with that. I'm continue to be happy with the staff analysis and the new agenda decision. Thank you.
Okay, Andrew, so I'll let you in. Okay, excellent.
Just to try and be constructive in thinking about the same paragraph as was previously raised, the third from the end.
If another sentence went in which said, however, it is the entity needs to consider whether it has retained exposure to investment at actuarial risk, that would really help me get there.
I had a slightly different suggestion, but that one can be on the table as well.
Okay. All right. So, Katrina? I've got the draft in front.
So if we look at pages 14 and 15 then, so what I heard and what I think we can do is page 14, some of the new words near the top where we talk about, for example, assessing the manner. I heard suggestion of manner and frequency in which annual contributions, etc. I don't have the exact words, but there's the suggestion from Mary that we try to make just a slightly stronger link between talking about in the case where there is a benefit formula in a sense built into the plan, that when we're thinking about that, you know, assessing the manner and frequency of contributions or whatever, we make a kind of link to then talking about, you know, thinking about whether that benefit formula has any effect on sort of actuarial risk and investment risk, so a way of sort of linking that through to the, for example, a bit below. So I don't have exact words there, but we try to craft to make that link. And then the other thought that I had is, if I turn over to page 15, the consequently paragraph third from the end, is if people felt it would be helpful to add in at the end of that. So we concluded our right to does not in itself, you know, nonetheless the committee reiterated the importance of assessing all the relevant terms and conditions and former practices, etc., as, you know, outlined earlier in the agenda decision.
Okay. So with that, let you digest for a second. If I could get a show of hands from the committee on whether you support the finalising the agenda decision with the amendments as proposed by Petrina.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. But he was a hot.
It's sobered everybody. It's like it's gone like quiet. Right. Well done.